Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns on its last obstacle to industry control, Apple.
They would have a different vision of their own, and they just got tired of Steve calling them idiots and this and that.
It was like an orgasm.
The people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
For the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself.
Hello, I'm Bobby Johnson, and you're listening to a Guardian Tech Weekly podcast special. It's 25 years since Apple first unveiled the Macintosh, a brand that helped revolutionise the PC industry and create the home computer as we know it. Over the next half an hour or so, we're going to hear from some of the people involved in building the Mac in 1984, as well as those who've used it over the years since then. Along the way, we'll hear who it was that Steve Jobs called idiots. We'll get our hands on some of the earliest Macintosh prototypes, and we'll discover whether or not it lived up to its early promise. So sit down and boot up as we find out how the Mac was made. On January the 24th, 1984, during a commercial break during the third quarter of the Super Bowl, Apple launched something new to the world, a modern personal computer.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the information purification directives. You created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology. We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
The Macintosh, as it was known, cost $2,500 and had a graphical user interface, windows, menus, and icons, plus a strange new input device known as the mouse. Today, we might take all those things for granted, but it wasn't always that way. I took a trip just a few miles from where Apple was founded in 1976 to find out more. So I'm here at the Computer History Museum with Dag Spicer, who's the senior curator here. Dag, we're in a hall that's full of all kinds of treasures, really, if you're a geek like us. But what's this we've got in front of us now?
What we're looking at now is an Apple I computer. This was the first machine that Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs built. It's basically a simple circuit board. You had to provide your own power supply and TV monitor to make it work, and keyboard. Sold for $666.66. Basically, these two Steves built it, and I quote them here, as a way of showing off to their friends. So they wanted to show what they could do at places like the Homebrew Computing Club, which was a big local monthly gathering of computer nerds in the 70s. And the Apple I is really what got people interested in Wozniak's potential. And he, based on the sales of this, about 220 were made in total, founded Apple Computer with Steve Jobs.
The circuit board is kind of open to the elements, and we've got a kind of wooden construction around here. We'll move on to the Apple II now, which was the machine that really made Apple their first mass market machine, and looks very different for a start. There's no wood involved, as far as I can tell. What's the place of this in history?
There was a point in which every school in California had at least one Apple computer donated by Apple. In fact, Jobs went to Washington and lobbied congressmen to get special dispensations so that schools could afford to buy his computers. The Apple II was a really nice evolution of personal computers. If you consider the Apple I, which was built for a boffin, a hobbyist, people built them in crazy things like bread boxes and briefcases. You had to be good at it with a soldering iron. The Apple II, on the other hand, was really a consumer mass-produced product. You could actually carry it with you. It was quite portable. The keyboard was built in. All you needed was a monitor or even a TV set to start playing. It also had color.
Programmer Andy Hertzfeld was an early fan of the Apple II and eventually joined Apple in 1979 to work on some of the company's hardware. Things were going fine until, in 1981, he was asked to join a mysterious division working on a brand new product, the Macintosh.
Initially, I wrote all the low-level software, the device drivers, the thing that made the keyboard and the mouse and the disk drive work. I worked on some of the higher-level software, what's called the user interface toolbox that made the menus and the windows and the controls.
So what did it feel like? I mean, you know, working on a GUI computer now seems commonplace. You know, you can't imagine not doing it that way. But at the time, did you feel like you were breaking new ground and doing something completely different?
Yeah, absolutely. We thought we were going to change the world. One of Steve Jobs's roles was to kind of keep drumming into us how important what we were doing was going to be to everyone. And we really believed it. We saw the Apple II was too complicated for ordinary people. So if we could make it easy to use, it would make a huge difference in society, in the lives of ourselves, our friends, everyone we knew.
You were a kind of breakout operation that nobody really seemed to think was actually going to make it through to the end. So what was, how did the rest of Apple look at you? How did you fit
in? Well,
at
first, very few resources. It was just a few outcasts, and no one thought it would amount to much. Apple II was the sort of cash cow driving the profitability of the company, and the Lisa was the big project of the future that Apple thought would be their future. The Mac was kind of a funny hybrid between the two, and no one thought much of it. A lot of Apple thought it was the Steve Jobs back to the garage fantasy.
That was a great presentation you made in there.
Do you know, I put together that entire project, including the presentation slides, just this morning.
Had your whole department working on it, huh?
No, I used my new Lisa personal computer.
A personal computer did all of that?
That's right.
Incredible.
The Lisa computer is incredible. In just a few moments, it helped me adjust a schedule chart.
Was there a lot of tension between the different groups who had different visions of where the company might be going?
Certainly there was some tension between the Macintosh team and the Lisa team, because Lisa started 2 years before the Macintosh, but they saw that, hey, this thing is going to be a lot cheaper, and it wasn't helped by Steve Jobs going around to everyone saying, the Macintosh is great and Lisa stinks.
They had a building of their own.
Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak was also involved in the early days of the Mac.
I had all my friends over there, and I'd go visit the building, talk to Steve all the time in there, and loved the Macintosh group, man. They were just designed around, how can you be free thinkers? You know, everything was very open, and they had a lot of the pillows you sit on when you're meditating and thinking things out that way, and they had beds so they could stay all night long, you know. They did things that Google does these days.
As the brains behind Apple's early hardware, he was part of the company's engineering team, and eventually found his way to the Macintosh project. He saw some of the tensions inside the company firsthand, and even after taking leave from Apple following an aircraft accident, he kept in close contact with the Mac team.
Steve called me over one time and he said, you've got to see this ad. He sat me down in front of a U-Matic tape machine and played the 1984 ad one time. And I was stunned because I was a bit naive. I thought it was just incredible science fiction. The sounds going along, the woman running, she's kind of fighting some big authority figure. It was very rebellious in a sense. And I said, wow, we're going to show this on the Super Bowl? This is the best ad I'd ever seen. And Steve said, well, the board sort of turned it down because it cost too much. It cost like $800,000. And I didn't realize the board turned it down because they were shaky about coming out, you know, against Big Blue, against the big companies that were so organized and structured.
Hi, I'm Steve Jobs. It is now 1984. It appears IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns on its last obstacle to industry control, Apple.
I didn't realize that. I thought it was the money. So I thought about it, you know. And Steve and I were fairly wealthy by then. I said, well, I'll pay half of it if you will. If you'll pay the other half, you know, this thing should be shown. I mean, this is us. You know, it was such a good demonstration of how we were out there trying to challenge the norm.
You probably saw Steve take control of the Mac team because he was, you know, he was with Lisa, really, wasn't he? That was the project that he...
Well,
was behind.
I think he inspired Lisa, hired the right people, a lot of them from Hewlett-Packard, a lot from Digital Equipment, some very bright academicians that thought about computers working for humans. I think they really created the world that is today, Macintosh. within Apple. But they didn't like Steve's personality, because Steve would have a vision and they would fight it. They would have a different vision of their own. And they just got tired of Steve calling them idiots and this and that. So Steve, yeah, was disfavored there. And he went over and spotted the Macintosh. And really, he helped set up the Macintosh division. He put those renegades that I described, all the little renegades in Apple, the ones that were my best friends, even myself. I think it was Steve that came to me and said, why don't you go over to the Macintosh group? Jeff's there, and Andy's there, and Burl's there. And okay, I said. So Steve was already on top of that. He just ran over and took the day-to-day management of it because he wanted to make the Lisa, but at a lower cost.
Steve Jobs had already made enemies inside the Lisa team, but the arguments weren't over when he moved to Mac. Jeff Raskin, who had conceived the Macintosh project in the first place, ended up leaving the company after falling out with Jobs over the direction things were going in.
Jeff had the initial vision for the Macintosh, which was surprisingly true to the finished product, which was a low-cost, high-volume, consumer-oriented machine that would be incredibly simple to use. No matter how cheap you made it, if people couldn't figure out how to use it, it would not be useful.
But what was the first Macintosh actually like? Andy Hertzfeld showed me around some of the prototypes and his original machine.
So what we've got here, I suppose this is a hallowed object, isn't it?
Yes.
In this bag, we've got
Macintosh original carrying case. The most ecstatic moment was that day of introduction. And after the introduction, the Macintosh division employees came back to the office and a big truck pulled up and they gave each employee their very own Macintosh with a little plaque on it. This is the one they gave to me here. But then here's a really interesting artifact, which is one of the Mac wire wrap prototypes that was already scavenged for chips. It doesn't have all the chips in there. Yeah. This was the third Macintosh prototype ever made. I had it on my desk for a year or so to write the original hardware drivers.
What were the little tricks that you used that nobody had done before?
Essentially, the same kind of fundamental tricks that Woz used, using the timing of the processor to replace hardware. Most implementations of a disk drive would have logic and hardware to do the timing for writing the bits on the disk. That's all done in software on the Macintosh.
I asked Dag Spicer from the Computer History Museum precisely what the change meant to computer users at the time.
It's a very small, self-contained unit. It's even got a handle that's built into the case, so it's made to be portable. There wasn't a lot of software. So a lot of the initial sales were probably for early adopters, people who typically buy the latest thing just because it is the latest thing. They were fairly expensive. However, they offered what is a stunning development, which was the graphical user interface. And this was a way of using a computer that we're all used to now because of Windows. The idea of using folders and icons and a trash can on your and a basic desktop. A lot of your listeners probably won't remember the time when you talked to a computer just by issuing words and typing in English-like sentences to get it to do things like to copy a file over or so on. Well, unfortunately, there was a pretty steep learning curve, and you had to know what all these incantations and secret words were ahead of time before you could do any useful work. So the big difference with the Mac was a complete novice, indeed, children, 10-year-olds, even 5-year-olds who had never even seen a computer before, seemed to instantly and intuitively lunge for the mouse and make a mental connection between their hand movements and what was on the screen.
Talking about the graphical interface, I mean, the Mac here is conveniently located next to a machine from Xerox, which is an early 70s workstation. Now, a lot of people, whenever the idea of Apple pioneering the graphical user interface comes along, a lot of people say, but they just stole it from Xerox. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate, or did they steal it, or did they bring it to more people?
I think steal is a bit of a strong word, because Apple, in fact, had an agreement, a formal agreement with Xerox to share technology. And it was actually part of a routine visit that Jobs made to Xerox Park during which he saw the Alto function. You know, Thomas Edison, for example, didn't invent or discover a lot of things. He also did, but a lot of the things he did, he didn't. He got from other people, but he refined them. Like the light bulb is a perfect example. The British physicist Alexander Fleming really discovered the effect at which, you know, burning a little filament could produce light. But he couldn't, for the life of him, make it work. So, you know, I think the credit deservedly goes to the person or the entity who brings it to the masses.
Steve Wozniak also remembers the influence of the work from Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center on the Macintosh project.
We went over to Xerox PARC and we saw their GUI machine, a little mouse device, kind of crude by today's standards, and a little cursor that could scan the screen. You could click something and a whole program would open up, and another, and we thought, whoa, you know, all of a sudden, the world can point at things. And we didn't even think ahead to where drag and drop would come. But look at where was the first drag and drop program ever. What I know of is it's the Mac Finder. You take an icon, you grab it with the mouse and drag it into a folder, pop, it pops into that folder. The only thing we didn't think of was the mouse as sort of remote control. Well, Apple got to work, you know, and we did. Steve's approach on the early Macintosh was, let's do what was successful with the Apple II. You do a computer, here's one that Xerox is making for $50,000. You do it, and you get your best people at reducing the amount of hardware, reducing the amount of software, reusing things in certain ways, so you can get the cost down to where it's affordable. But it was pictures and graphics. That meant that the core of the operating system was written around how to draw graphics, icons, how to draw pictures of things like cursors, how to make little things move on the screen, and the only thing the Mac didn't do well in that regard was color. And that's largely because we didn't know it, but Bill Atkinson, the graphics designer, was colorblind. That was just an accident we didn't know.
By the beginning of 1982, Apple was beginning to realize, hey, this Macintosh thing could be pretty cool. And then by 1983, after the Lisa shipped, it did not have the initial sales that were expected. People started investing their hopes in the Macintosh. And by the time the Mac shipped in January 1984, it was kind of bet the company. You know, it was clearly the most important thing at the company and the future of Apple.
Over the years, Apple has become one of the most recognizable brands in the world. And for most of that time, the Mac has been central to its image. As a result, the machine's gathered many fans, notorious for their passionate and some say rabid support of the company and its products. Each year, thousands of them make the pilgrimage to San Francisco's Macworld Expo, where they find out about the latest new machines and software, and share their stories.
I've been a Mac fanatic for about 30 years, or let's say 20. I love all Apple products, they're beautiful. But then, you know, every year they change, so you have to have deep pockets. With Mac, you have to have deep pockets.
And after 20 years of being a Mac fan, I suppose it takes its toll.
You know that movie about the house, you know, and there's a money pit in there? Just throw your move. Every month, every 6 months or something, they change. Yeah. And I've been through the whole history of the Macintosh.
What was your first experience of Mac, and what switched you on?
I can absolutely tell you. I was a member of the newspaper staff in college in 1978 through 82. And we had a photo typesetting machine, and I learned how to use that and set type and do a newspaper. And when I graduated school, I had a friend in computer science who was following the industry, and he said, you should see this new machine that Apple's come out with. It's called the Mac. I think you'd really like it. And I wasn't interested in a personal computer. I didn't have any real need for it at the time. And I came out on a business trip, and we went to a computer store, and there was this Mac 128, and it was the most eye-opening experience. I sat down, never having seen it before, got into Mac Paint, started drawing, you know, started typing text and doing basic layout things, which even then you really couldn't do, but you could see the potential. I knew immediately I had to have the machine and never looked back.
You wouldn't know it from the success of Apple's computer business today, but after its initial and exciting launch, the Mac and Apple itself began to hit a rough patch. Sales were disappointing, the rot began to set in, and just a few months later, Macintosh cheerleader Steve Jobs had gone.
Apple, time to think for yourself.
John Sculley was the chief executive of Apple, and Steve Jobs was leading the Mac team. And we know that, you know, it wasn't too long afterwards that Steve left Apple.
At first, I thought they got along great, mainly because Sculley deferred to Steve. things would have continued to be fine. I wouldn't say it was a fundamental personality clash. What really happened was, after an initial start, the Macintosh sales did not meet expectations by the fall of 1984, especially the Christmas season. We were expecting to sell like 70,000 Macs in December of 1984, and they more sold like 3,000. So Scully, in his role as CEO, had to do something about it. And Steve is not the best person at dealing with when things aren't going well. You know, he will will them to go well, even if they're not. It's hard for him to really address the fundamental problems. And so that's when the tension started building there, I would say, starting in early 1985. And by the end of May 1985, he actually got stripped of his responsibilities. And in September of 1985, he left the company. And it almost destroyed the company. I mean, it's really easy to see with hindsight now when Steve left, a lot of the impetus and vision for the company left. Paradoxically, Apple started doing better financially because the Mac was incredibly worthwhile. We sowed the seeds of it in 1984 and 1985. Those seeds blossomed in 1986 and 1987. And by 1988, Apple was doing fantastically well, but not because of any great leadership from Scully. It was really just the course of evolution that we set in place. But then, as things progressed further, you know, Scully basically was a big phony. You know, he didn't have a real vision. And Apple, a lot of the people at Apple then were mercenary. The spirit of the Mac team, we were working out of a love of computers. And by the late 80s, I think the leadership of Apple was working out of a love for money, not a love for computers. Mm. Some of the wrong people got the stock options. So people who didn't do very much sometimes got very wealthy. And people who did some of the most important key work did not benefit financially so much. And so eventually they stopped doing great stuff. By the mid-90s, that original work we did had run its course, and they never replaced it with other great new stuff. So the company was in bad trouble.
Over the years, the Mac evolved, at least a little. Back at the Computer History Museum, I joined Dag Spicer for a walk through some of the successes to that first machine.
Good design and especially marketing, extremely important components of their products. It used to be said that IBM didn't sell computers, they sold service. Well, Apple, in a way, you could paraphrase that and say they don't sell computers, they sell dreams. And there were, you know, a few years there where Apple's products were not particularly good. Before Steve Jobs came back in 97, they were really struggling. In fact, they were basically going bankrupt. By providing a lot of Me Too kind of products that were not differentiated in any significant way from anyone else's products. You see, when Apple gets away from its basic philosophy of great design, ease of use, that it starts to struggle.
I noticed the ill-fated Cube Mac is up on the top shelf here. We've also got a 20th anniversary Mac here. That's from the 20th anniversary of Apple rather than the machine itself. But this is a weird looking machine compared to what we're used to. It looks more like a kind of a hi-fi or something, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It's very beautiful. It's very sculptural. In fact, for I think one season at least of Seinfeld, this was the computer that he had on his desk in his apartment.
That's before he started doing adverts for Microsoft, I suppose.
That must be, yes. But it's very beautiful. It's got a nice screen and a Bose sound system. It sounds terrific when you plug it in. Unfortunately, it was priced at around $10,000 to $12,000, which is about five times too much for the average computer buyer, even the very motivated ones. And sadly, within a year, they were selling for about $1,200. They're very collectible right now, the Apple Mac, 20th anniversary Mac, and just by themselves, they look, you know, kind of nice, even without being turned on yet.
On the shelf underneath, there's a kind of slightly menacing black box, which is actually a Next Cube, which is the company that Steve Jobs started once he left Apple and was kind of his wilderness years, I suppose. Yes. But it actually became the kind of progenitor of OS X. I mean, do you think it's kind of, you know, very well storied and everybody knows the kind of ins and outs of Jobs leaving and coming back. But what would have happened if this machine had stood on its own and been a viable product, we'd never have seen the Apple we see today, would we?
Well, what if questions are always, you know, really tough. But Jobs went ahead and, as he often does, just tried to do the best possible computer he could. It resulted in a beautifully sophisticated machine that was actually did fairly well in universities, but its price was a little too high. Again, I think it was in the $10,000 range, fully loaded with a color system and so on. You know, when you look at these products, if you think of the people behind them, you can actually find a really clear genealogy between people who worked on these products. For example, John Rubinstein, who's a former VP at Apple, was the head of hardware on the Next, and Jobs brought him to Apple when he came back in 97 to be his hardware engineering chief, and then he later led the iPod development and so on. So it's not so much the objects, although they're interesting by themselves, but the people behind the objects, especially in Apple, which is a very closed, insular culture, where being a friend of Steve's is the greatest blessing you can have. So there's DNA, I guess is what I'm saying. There's DNA in our current machines that can be traced way back. I mean, there's even in Windows machine, in Windows, there's code going way back to the early 80s, probably.
So, 25 years on, the computers we use are still, in many ways, very similar to that original Mac from 1984. Does it mean that it reached its potential? Or did some of the avenues that it opened up go unexplored? I asked Steve Wozniak if he thought the Mac had lived up to Jeff Raskin's original vision.
I'd say the early dreams of the Macintosh have led out because virtually everybody wants to work that way on a computer when they have a choice. Could we have imagined that we'd ever fit a song on a computer? That wasn't part of the early vision. We never thought a computer would have enough memory for that. This technology, though, was adapted to last 25 years. The internet came along. Maybe it defined the way we use the internet, partly because it was so much the way to use computers. It defined things like photo programs. Fit right into the paradigm of the graphical user interface, fit all of these things. You know, I mean, so, yeah, I'd say it fulfilled, it lived up to what we thought it would be.
As we looked over some of the memorabilia, equipment, and old photographs, I asked Andy Hertzfeld if working on the Mac was the most important thing he'd done in his career.
These are some of the key designers of the Macintosh. George Crowe on the far left there, Joanna Hoffman, the original marketing person, Burl Smith, who's holding...
How do you feel about being part of that team?
I think looking back with hindsight, it's clearly the most important thing I ever worked on, but I'm not happy about that. It's unfortunate. I thought at the time some of the other things I was doing post-Macintosh would be just as important, but it didn't work out that way. I did it when I was pretty young, so I maybe got a false impression of how hard it was to do revolutionary things. I gave it a try with some other things, but nothing came close to having the impact that the Macintosh had.
Do you ever drill down into what Macs do today?
To some extent. I mean, today the way I find out is I read about it on the web. I don't really reverse engineer it myself, but I do follow it.
Are there times when you boot up one of your Macs, I assume you've got several. Are there times when you boot it up and even 25 years after the fact, do you still feel like your fingerprints are on it?
Absolutely. In some ways, more than others, but a lot of the fundamental things are really still there, such as the menu bar at the top. That went away for the next software, but it came back in OS X. But more than any specific design element, it's the spirit is still there. That a little bit rebellious, a little bit humorous. I think the software still reeks of that somehow.
Do you think the you're saying about it lasting for 25 years? Do you think there's another 25 years, or do you think something else? You know, there needs to be a new paradigm that comes along.
It's hard to say. One of the things is for 25 years we've pretty much had a mouse and a keyboard as the total control of our computer. And in recent ages, we've seen one after another companies make tablets where you touch it with a special pen. We have touch screens that you can touch with your fingers. As soon as touchscreen costs less than a keyboard, the lowest cost computers will have to go touchscreen.
Without giving away any of the things you might know, because obviously you still have contact
with Apple. What do you think the future of Mac is? Do you think we're gonna see it exist in the same form for a long time? Do you think it will eventually morph into something different? Because it's been the same.
I think it'll be a similar form for a very long time in the future. It'd be very difficult for people to switch over to a new technology. You know, it's got to be something natural to a human being. I do think gesturing could possibly replace a mouse someday, but I don't think it won't be 100% and it won't be real quick.
These days, Apple is riding high. The company just had its best Christmas in history and is selling more Macs, iPods and iPhones than ever before. But while that's guaranteed the Macintosh's prospects for the foreseeable future, will it carry on that way? Will we be looking back at the centenary of the Mac in 75 years' time?
The world would be a kind of crummier place, I think, without one. If there were only one car company, the world would be pretty boring. So I think we've been lucky and really fortunate to have essentially Steve Jobs. I mean, which is why it's so troublesome that he's in ill health, because he is so much the vision of that company. He's the one who made that decision about not putting a floppy drive on the Mac once it got to a certain point. You know, said, who uses a floppy?
The way I think of it is it's not so much the person of Steve Jobs, but those values he represent. And those values have taken root there. Mm. And also, I got to mention, too, that the Steve Wozniak values there, that he's the other co-founder of Apple, and Woz really hasn't been actively involved at Apple for decades or more, but somehow his key values are also part of that fabric. So and I think that illustrates how Steve Jobs' values could stay a part of it even after Steve is gone.
You've just seen some pictures of Macintosh. Now I'd like to show you Macintosh in person. All of the images you are about to see on the large screen will be generated by what's in that bag.
Was there something that still stands out to you as a key moment?
Well, I would say the highlight, at least looking back, was the day of the introduction. It was like an orgasm, a release of all that hard work for 3 years, finally unveiling it to the world.
Now, we've done a lot of talking about Macintosh recently, but today, for the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself.
Hello, I am Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag.
If you go trawling on eBay for vintage Apple stuff, which some of us spend more time doing than we should, I mean, do you kind of, your treasure trove of stuff that you have, would you give it to a museum or something, or do you like to keep that for yourself?
Well, it has sentimental value to me, and so it's the kind of thing that has value to me but wouldn't have much value to someone else, so it makes sense for me to keep it, to occasionally reminisce about, but you know, like after I'm gone, I don't think anyone cares. It just doesn't matter.
That's it from me, Bobby Johnson, and our look back at 25 years of the Mac. So there's just time for me to say thank you to Steve Wozniak, Andy Hertzfeld, and the visitors to the Macworld Expo, as well as Dag Spicer and everyone at the Computer History Museum. You can discuss the past, present, and future of the Macintosh on the Guardian website at guardian.co.uk/technology, where you'll also find all the latest news and opinion on the technology world.